Welcome to Oncology Today, Optimizing the Management of Metastatic Triple-Negative Breast Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Tiffany Traina from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. And in addition to this interview, there's also a video recording featuring Dr. Traina's full-length slide presentation. To begin, I asked her how she approaches the choice of chemotherapy to combine with pembrolizumab when treating PD-1-positive metastatic triple-negative breast cancer in the first-line setting.
As we know from KEYNOTE-355, in that first-line setting, pembrolizumab was combined with either paclitaxel, nab-paclitaxel, or carboplatin in combination with gemcitabine. And I think often those are really the traditional cytotoxic agents we'll reach for. How I choose between them is really driven by disease-free interval. You know, how long ago did they have their adjuvant therapy? Is this a really short disease-free interval, which has me a bit more concerned? Do they have residual neuropathy from their early-stage taxane exposure? And that might drive me towards one chemotherapy option over another. You know, another place where I may be leading with a platinum in the first line setting are those patients that have both PD-L1 positive tumors and maybe germline BRCA positive, because in that setting, guidelines would recommend leading with the checkpoint inhibitor. When, you know, the earlier we use that, the better the benefit. But we also want to leverage that platinum in the patient who does have a germline mutation. So great, I think oftentimes it's driven by the data, driven by the patient's comorbidities, and driven by patient preference. There are schedule differences and toxicity differences.
What about the elderly patient or patient with a lot of comorbidities? It's really question mark chemotherapy at all. I've heard people talk about CMF and all kinds of stuff. Any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, we've been fortunate to have good safety data for pembrolizumab combinations with chemotherapy from other disease states outside of breast. But also even within phase two studies that have been conducted in the metastatic setting, we know there's safety data combining capecitabine with pembrolizumab. So, you know, while it may not be in the guidelines, we know there's safety. And if we're concerned about tolerability, comorbidities, and somebody who might be more frail, you could imagine that that could be an option.
So you refer to a disease-free survival in patients who've gotten prior therapy. And in your talk, you commented on the fact that the subset analysis from the KEYNOTE study, they didn't really see benefit when people relapsed within a year. It kind of reminded me of some of the discussions that's going on ER-positive breast cancer, where, you know, time on CDK, or of course, obviously time on adjuvant, you know, that sort of model fits in. For practical purposes, are you still giving the pembro? Any thoughts about what's going on biologically?
Mm-hmm. I think we're all really waiting to see some of the data around checkpoint inhibitor benefit upon progression on prior checkpoint inhibitor. And we don't have that data really. So I look back to KEYNOTE-355 and say, gosh, for those really short disease-free interval, rapid progressors, they did not seem to derive benefit from pembro even without having seen prior checkpoint inhibitor. And so that's a space where I am really trying to lean into clinical trials, looking towards some of our new novel antibody drug conjugates or studies that might be combining the checkpoint inhibitor with something more novel. In the absence of any other wonderful option, I am inclined to re-challenge, but my optimism about the benefit I'm gaining from using the checkpoint inhibitor there is much lower.
Any comments about the issue of re-biopsy at a metastatic disease, but also while having metastatic disease, also incorporating liquid biopsy?
Yeah, fabulous question. So in this setting of first-line metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, we are compelled as a standard of care to biopsy for proof of metastatic disease. So tissue is really important at this point, particularly in triple-negative breast cancer, when we are always looking for a potential target for therapy. The value in repeating a biopsy to confirm metastatic disease is we not only will be looking for ER and PR and potentially capturing some ER lows, but we'll test for HER2. And I'm sure we'll get into talking about the importance of designating HER2-low as now an actionable target. So I would say in the diagnosis of metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, we need tissue. But circulating tumor DNA is actually a very friendly, easy way to get deeper molecular testing on our patients. And that's critically important for looking at other targetable mutations, like somatic BRCA mutations that could be targeted, or ERBB2, or a host of other potential targets that could make our patients eligible for studies, or even potentially off-label use of drugs that are available.
You know, the other issue that sort of snuck up on me, so I can never tell if I'm the last person to realize this is an issue or nobody, or the first, but this just kind of crept up on me the last few months as I started thinking about it. Actually, I saw a couple papers on ER low, mm-hmm. 0 to 10%. And I started thinking about it, and I've asked a couple people about it, and it's starting to worry me. First of all, you know, now that we have 522, if they're triple negative, they're likely to go down that route, where if you believe they're ER positive, I guess they wouldn't. I don't know if you could do both. What do you do with these patients?
Yeah, so certainly a difference in our early stage approach versus our metastatic approach. And in early stage triple negative breast cancer, you know, I will say that I am more inclined to treat my ER lows as triple negative and eligible for a Keynote regimen. You know, there are several data series that would suggest that population really behaves like triple negative breast cancer. I want to give them every benefit at curative therapy. And then I may actually use an adjuvant endocrine therapy anyway to cover all my bases. In metastatic triple negative breast cancer, I think this is where personalization and clinical characteristics are very important. So somebody who has ER 10% metastatic disease, their PD-L1 testing is negative, they've got bone only and maybe a lymph node, right? Perhaps frail, you know, this is somebody that may very well warrant an attempt at endocrine therapy and targeted therapy with close monitoring to see if they really have endocrine sensitive disease. The tissue that's biopsied is important as well. If you've done a bone biopsy and you've come back with ER low, but perhaps you're finding a PI3 kinase mutation, which sounds very much like a hormonal signature tumor, I may give that woman the benefit of the doubt and try an endocrine and targeted therapy approach before going down the line of cytotoxic therapy in a triple negative paradigm.
Just out of curiosity, have you actually seen a patient with metastatic disease and, you know, ER low, you know, 0 to 5% or whatever, 0 to 10%, who clearly benefited from endocrine treatment?
I have. And that's why I always keep this in my differential. You know, there's exactly the prototype I described of a woman who may be a little bit older than what we typically see in TNBC. You know, I'm thinking of two patients that were in their early 60s, had bone and nodal disease, came back ER low, but had had a long disease-free interval and an ER positive primary in the past. And now their tumor was testing ER low. I gave an attempt at AI and CDK4/6 inhibitor and had benefit beyond a year on therapy. So that's a valuable year in maintaining healthy organ function, maximizing quality of life in a cancer that treatment is really palliative.
So, you know, well, of course, one of the main things I want to talk to you about is ADCs and metastatic triple negative. There's so much to talk about there. I wondered how long it was going to be before I could resist asking you what's new in terms of androgen receptor targeting. And just by talking about ER a little bit got me thinking about it. But I don't know if you remember that. I think I told you that we launched Research to Practice with a video called Hormonal Therapy for the 1980s. That's how we started. So, you know, I remember halotestin, which is an impeded androgen that, you know, actually caused, we had it in that original tape. Anyhow, I know this has been an interest of yours over the years. Can you kind of update the audience, who I'm sure also knows about this? And, you know, so much wild stuff going on in prostate cancer nowadays. I've been just waiting to see whether anything would leak into breasts in terms of anti-androgens, et cetera. So what's new? And maybe just review a little bit about what we know about the frequency of androgen receptors and the intensity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, happy to answer that. So the androgen receptor by immunohistochemical testing is present in triple negative breast cancer anywhere from about a third to 50% of the time. And there have been numerous phase two single arm trials over the years that have looked at AR antagonists like bicalutamide and enzalutamide that have shown clinical benefit in women who had AR positive TNBC. We've also looked at CYP17 inhibitors, right? Borrowing from agents that have been really successful in the prostate cancer space. And so all of these phase two single arm studies have looked encouraging for a signal of benefit. And we've really needed sort of a deep randomized trial that could have rich tissue collection to do a better job at defining the biomarker that could predict benefit for women. And so we have a study that is actively recruiting across the country through the TBCRC that is a three-arm trial looking at enzalutamide versus enzalutamide with mifepristone. Mifepristone is a glucocorticoid receptor antagonist, and it has a role in resistance to enzalutamide in the prostate cancer space. So we're checking to see if that doublet might actually be an approach for breast cancer. And then the third arm in that study is standard of care chemotherapy. And this trial is recruiting women who have metastatic triple negative breast cancer with AR positive tumors. And there's also a cohort that will allow for women who have ER low breast cancer, ER 1 to 10%. Because unfortunately, in many of the other recruiting triple negative trials, those patients with ER low tumors are excluded. And so we know there's a good amount of co-expression of AR and ER, and we wanted to make this available in a really pragmatic trial to those patients as well. This study will have a lot of tissue collection and blood biomarkers collected to really try to answer the question, what is the right patient population that could derive benefit from an anti-androgen approach?
So I'm curious what you see in women getting enzalutamide. I don't know how much you follow the prostate literature, but you know, there's this huge EMBARK study that was in PSA-only disease, and enzalutamide beat androgen deprivation therapy, which has been the standard for 25 years. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're going to use the combination, but they had gynecomastia, which is a known effect in men. So I'm curious what you see with enzalutamide in women.
Yeah. You know, it's been in the single arm studies, there was a global phase two that we conducted. It was really well tolerated, actually, you know, compared to what the traditional therapies would be, which is essentially chemotherapy. This is an oral regimen, continuous daily dosing. We don't see much in the way of GI toxicity. We're not seeing alopecia. There was a little bit of, you know, fatigue, not surprisingly, but really well tolerated in general. Enzalutamide does lower the seizure threshold. And so the study excludes women who have brain metastases, even stable treated brain mets, because of that risk of seizure. And we do know that brain metastases are a concern in women with triple negative breast cancer. So that is one subset population that we need to be cautious about for this approach.
So what happens to serum estrogen levels on enzalutamide?
Yeah, so, you know, we haven't studied that within enzalutamide itself. We did ages ago look at other serum biomarkers and hormone panels in the setting of the bicalutamide study. And there is a tight relationship between AR and ER. So I want to make the distinction that this particular work of antagonizing the androgen receptor seems to be a role in triple negative breast cancer. But where you have both ER positive and AR positive tumors, actually agonizing the androgen receptor has shown benefit. But that's a different story for the ER positive tumors.
Interesting. For docs who want to get involved with the study, can they send off for an androgen receptor IHC?
It is. It's an immunohistochemical test that's done by pathologists. There's published methodology from that phase two global enzalutamide study as to how to do the testing with the particular antibody. And we've set for the study a threshold of 10% or greater nuclear staining to count as positive.
That sounds exciting. So let's get back to ADCs and so many questions that there are about them. And before we kind of get into some of the more challenging, controversial ones, like does it matter whether there's a target there or not, and how do you sequence ADCs, maybe we can get more into some of the basics. I mean, maybe start now with sacituzumab. You know, ask our consultants, which we ask about it. We go, oh, we've used it a lot, we know, whatever. But I'm curious whether when you see second opinions, if there are any myths, misperceptions, or things about using sacituzumab that are worth bringing up in a CME platform. Of course, the issue of cytopenias and growth factors, we get a lot of questions about GI toxicity. Any nuances of those issues that you want to talk about?
Oh, for sure. So the data from sacituzumab in the ASCENT trial has been really transformative in triple-negative breast cancer. It's the first ADC that we had in TNBC. It was the first time we saw such a substantial improvement in overall survival for patients who really were struggling with inadequate benefit from chemotherapy, traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy. And now, even with longer-term follow-up, we see just profound response rates, progression-free survival, and a 50% improvement in overall survival. And I'll say, while those are really exciting data from the trial, in practice, I see that benefit for my patients. So when I'm reaching for sacituzumab, you know, really it's a second line treatment for me. And as I'm sure we'll talk about, trials going on in the first line setting to try to move that up even sooner, I see response rates and benefit for my patients. As you've already alluded to with KEYNOTE-522, you know, patients with TNBC have likely seen a lot of chemotherapy already for their early stage treatment. Anthracycline, taxane, platinum, pembro, and possibly even adjuvant capecitabine. So when they're faced with either first line or second line metastatic disease, that tends to be a very chemo refractory kind of cancer. And sacituzumab affords great responses and durable responses. The common toxicities you alluded to around cytopenia and diarrhea are common, yet they are really in the wheelhouse of oncologists in managing adverse events. So in my practice for growth factor support, I tend to use a day 8 long-acting pegylated growth factor. It helps for patient convenience, and it's often enough to carry them through a day 1, day 8 schedule. For the diarrhea, there's a lot of patient education, a lot of nursing support to be sure our patients have Imodium in the house, and to not be shy about intervening early, stay well hydrated, and even a little bit of dose modification and dose reduction from 10 milligram per kilogram to 7.5 milligram per kilogram can make a world of difference and make this a really tolerable regimen that gives clinical benefit.
In your talk, you alluded to the issue of CNS activity and sacituzumab. I couldn't exactly read how much CNS activity the drug actually has. I mean, do you actually see responses in the brain?
Yeah, so what the data has shown us from the ASCENT study is that progression-free survival favored sacituzumab over standard of care chemotherapy in patients who had brain metastases on the ASCENT trial, recognizing it's a small subset of a much larger trial. So those numbers are tiny, but it appeared that there was benefit in terms of PFS. You know, I do think having a drug that gives you good extracranial control of your disease is likely to have a downstream benefit in improving and reducing likelihood even of developing CNS metastases. So I do think there's a signal of activity there.
I mean, you know, would you apply the famous EGFR model, and you have a patient with a few brain mets that are not symptomatic and they're small and they're going to go on sacituzumab, would you hold off on radiation to the brain and see if they responded?
That's a bit of a tougher question, and I think it's one that is really a multidisciplinary discussion to have. So involving the radiation oncologist in that conversation, it's quite easy these days to be able to do SRS and really minimize the longer-term consequences of radiation. And, you know, we don't quite have the same level of data that we do in, say, the HER2-positive space, where a drug like tucatinib can really improve overall survival in the CNS. So I'm a little bit more inclined to do my local therapy and optimize my systemic therapy in parallel.
Yeah, of course, you know, when you need whole brain radiation, that's a different story. But, you know, they're so aggressive using SRS, I'm not sure they use whole brain anymore. Anyhow, another thing that, you know, you brought up that always vexes me and this is, you know, across oncology. Obviously, we talk about ADCs, almost every tumor, it seems like to me. One of the issues is the target. And do you need the target? And you brought up in your talk that you see benefit from sacituzumab, even in patients with low levels, or I don't know if you ever get absent levels of TROP2. Any sort of general thoughts about why that is the case, how you visualize the way an ADCs work? I mean, in a way, that kind of model is starting to apply to TDXD, right? Now we're going to HER2-low, HER2-ultra-low. And do we even need to look at it? You know, anyhow, I don't know if there's an answer, but just kind of curious about your thoughts.
Yeah, I noodle this a bit myself, too. So we know from the subset data around TROP2 expression, both from the triple negative space in ASCENT, as well as in the hormone receptor positive trials, that regardless of level of TROP2 expression, sacituzumab outperformed standard of care chemotherapy. And so I think part of it, the question is just how low can you go? How much target expression is necessary? Because many of these linkers and payloads are able to allow for diffusion of payload into neighboring cells that may not express the target. And I think that as our payloads are more effective, as our sensitivity and binding strength improves, I think we'll see the story pan out just like it is in TDXD, that it's really going to depend on each ADC and how it's engineered. So I actually love the fact that sacituzumab is working regardless of TROP2 expression, because our patients with triple negative breast cancer are constantly hearing that they are lacking a biomarker to access these great treatments. And to have a powerful drug that improves the overall survival without needing to test for a biomarker, I think is great for our patients.
You know, another situation where you see, it seems like everybody benefits is with enfortumab. And you mentioned that now being looked at in breast cancer, but of course, oncologists already, it's now first line with pembro in metastatic bladder. Right. It beat the hell out of cisplatin combination. So, you know, fascinating. But again, everybody seems to benefit. Incidentally, before we, I'm curious about that, but also, I hear kind of challenging things about enfortumab. How does it go with breast cancer in terms of toxicity? Have you actually used it on a trial?
Yes. Actually, we presented our data for the cohort of patients with triple negative breast cancer and hormone positive breast cancer using enfortumab in breast cancer. And, both cohorts had signal of activity, of response rates. The study did not meet its primary endpoint for response, but I do think that there is a place to, do more exploration there and understanding biomarkers, right? Regardless of Nectin-4 expression, that didn't appear to predict for benefit from the ADC in breast cancer, but I do think there's a little bit more work to be done there. And as you've mentioned, in GU malignancies, combination with pembro is really outstanding. So could there be opportunity there for a combination even in breast to augment the benefits? I think we need to see that. In terms of toxicity, one of the more common toxicities is a skin adverse event and rash, but that actually can be well managed. We had dermatology engagement throughout that clinical trial, and so there were recommendations on how to help with that.
Right, yeah, Dr. Pals, we work with him a lot, and he has his whole team go in there and talk to these people about the dermatologic thing before they even get started. We'll see what happens. You did have a 20% response rate, so, there's maybe something there.
I think that having development of antibody-drug conjugates that explore different targets with different payloads is absolutely necessary, because what we are struggling with is the question about how do we sequence agents that have the same payload but a different target, and is that of benefit, or should we be mixing up the target and perhaps a different mechanism of action on our payload? Understanding those mechanisms of resistance to first ADC could really better inform how we choose our subsequent ADCs.
And again, we hear this discussed in a number of other tumors, but here, for practical purposes, in terms of triple negative breast cancer, in terms of sequencing ADCs, I guess we're really talking about HER2-low and sacituzumab and TDXD, which we'll get to in a second, because I'm curious. I know there was some data presented that, again, you went through in your talk. I'm always curious about that. It is really complicated, at least it seems to me. And then also you have other ADCs coming along, Dato and others as well. One of the things you see a lot of, you were talking about trials of first line, ADC, sacituzumab, for example, tropion. Everybody wants to add an IO to chemo, or more importantly, like ADC, like they do in bladder cancer. And I guess there's sacituzumab. You have the one that's not going, you know, PD-1 positive is going to get, I guess, SG plus pembro versus chemo plus pembro, and the other in patients who are less than 10 or zero. What do we know about sacituzumab and IO?
Yeah. So, I mean, we know from phase two studies that the combination is safe. And I think, as I mentioned before, that first line setting, when patients have recurred with a short disease-free interval from their neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy, you know, is really a huge space and unmet need for our patients with crying out for a more active agent. So it's a natural interest in moving those powerful ADCs up into the first line setting. We have safety for the combination with checkpoint inhibitor. So I find this a really encouraging opportunity. We have, from the ASCENT studies, as you alluded to, combination SG and pembrolizumab. We have safety data from the Begonia platform trial, which Begonia has multiple cohorts in the first-line setting metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. And within there, we've seen combination Dato-DXd with durvalumab, and we have data for T-DXd with durvalumab. So I think a lot going on in that space where patients have PD-L1 positive tumors, we want to incorporate the checkpoint inhibitor. And for patients who have PD-L1 negative tumors, you know, moving up those ADCs seems very promising to me.
So, you know, we're very practical, research to practice. And here's a question I was sort of thinking about last night I want to ask you, which is, let me start out with a patient who presents with de novo metastatic triple negative breast cancer. Let's remove prior therapy as an issue. And I'm curious, in general, how you would sequence systemic therapy in a patient who's HER2, let's say zero, if there is such a thing, mm-hmm. HER2 ultra low, which I guess we don't know much about in triple negative, but still curious.
Correct.
HER2 low, yeah. We'll skip HER2 positive for now. But let's start with de novo. How would you sequence?
Yep. So let's say de novo metastatic triple negative breast cancer, BRCA normal and PD-L1 positive. In that first line setting, we'll go outside of clinical trials, pembrolizumab with either a taxane or platinum gem. And there, the choice between the two, I'm comfortable with either. I really have a conversation with my patients. There are differences in schedule. There's differences in alopecia, et cetera. So that would be my go-to first line. And let's imagine they get great long benefit, but eventually, unfortunately, progression of disease. There in that second line setting, HER2 zero, I'm inclined to use sacituzumab. If HER2 low, I'm still inclined to lead with sacituzumab in TNBC. I do think there's an opportunity to use trastuzumab deruxtecan in that place. From DESTINY-Breast04, we had data, a small cohort, but data for patients with hormone receptor negative HER2 low tumors, and their benefit from T-DXd really appeared to mirror the overall hormone receptor positive population, significant benefits in PFS and overall survival. However, the ASCENT study is a large randomized trial, more than 500 women with triple negative breast cancer, showing an OS advantage from sacituzumab. So I tend to sequence SASI first and then T-DXd after in my patients who have HER2 low triple negative breast cancer. The question you raised about HER2 ultra low is a great one. From DESTINY-Breast06, it's important to remember that is a hormone receptor positive trial. There are no patients with hormone receptor negative HER2 ultra low disease studied. So I think we need to see those data. There are upper level DESTINY trials that'll be looking at this and looking at it in combinations. We have to understand really what will the FDA label look like around defining HER2 ultra low. But I think for now, it's enough of a challenge in talking with our pathologists about being sure we're finding those patients that have HER2 low disease to help us sequence.
Have you seen a patient yourself respond well who had HER2 ultra low? I don't know if you were on the study or not.
Well, sure. Within the context of the study, I have not done this outside the context of DB06. It does look like from the data, there is a little bit of a dose response, if you will. The hazard ratio from DB06 in those patients who had 1+2+ disease, HER2 low, appeared to be greater than the hazard ratio for patients who had HER2 ultra low disease, right? The hazard ratio there, I think, was 0.78, right, as opposed to a stronger hazard ratio with the HER2 low category. But again, the numbers smaller for the subset.
Yeah, Dr. Sirigliano tries to make that point that there's kind of a continuum, which is, I think, what you're saying.
Exactly.
So yep. I'm envisioning a situation where your patients had a great first-line response, you've had a great response to sacituzumab, maybe they had a couple other chemo things after that, and they're still in good condition, and they're HER2 ultra low. If you could, would you try it?
You know, what I would say is I would have a conversation with my pathologist about looking at the tissue we have, looking back at what's been biopsied, and, you know, to call HER2 low, 1+, you know, I think our pathologists have really been focused on making sure they're not missing the 3+ as compared to 2+. This is a whole new world of being sure our pathologists can distinguish the 0 versus 1+. So I've seen some data that upon repeat biopsies over time, the more you go looking, the more likely you are to find HER2 low. So it raises the question, you know, if it's been a while since I've had a tissue biopsy, I may rebiopsy to really try to find HER2 low before making the leap to ultra low in TNBC.
The other side of me whispered it in my ear. They had a fair amount of ILD in DESTINY-Breast06. And then, you know, all the DESTINY trials. So, you know, you can say, well, people run out of options, but then you treat them, they get ILD, and they have no data. That's a difficult situation as well. I want to get to your cases in a second, but anything else you want to say about T-DXd in general? I feel like we talk about it all the time, but on the other hand, I feel like we can't talk about it enough. You know, one of the standard questions that, you know, comes up all the time, and, you know, this really is getting to be an issue now with the pan-tumor approval, because now you've got GU people, GI, all kinds of other people weighing in, and a lot of them haven't even used T-DXd. So, and they all looking to you in terms of what do you do, how do you manage these patients? And you made the point in your talk that you can see a fair amount of acute GI toxicity. I'm curious what you see. Is it well palliated by good, you know, aggressive prevention? And how do you go about screening for ILD? Do you keep doing scans indefinitely as long as they're on treatment, as frequently as insurance will pay for it?
Lots of great questions packed in there. So I think T-DXd is a very active drug. And in the breast cancer community, we've had a long experience now in the traditional HER2 positive space that we can learn from and extrapolate as we move into HER2 low and potentially HER2 ultra low. So it has many, besides its tremendous efficacy and clinical benefit and high response rates, it has some additional features that are really favorable for our patients. You know, to be able to have a once every 3-week dosing regimen is quite favorable because most of the comparator chemotherapies we would be talking about are weekly treatments. There is a degree of alopecia with it, probably about 35% or so risk of alopecia. And there are studies going on looking at the benefits of scalp cooling together with the use of ADCs. So that remains to be seen and is a concern sometimes for our patients on treatment. The upper GI nausea, anorexia can be easily mitigated with using supportive strategies, right? Not being shy about having our patients armed with antiemetics. Fatigue is something else that I see commonly reported in my patients that are using this drug. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword, right? The benefits are so great. Women are on the therapy for a long time, not unusual to be beyond a year on T-DXd. And so fatigue, you know, we've got data that exercise actually helps mitigate fatigue. Dose modification, dose reduction, down one dose level can really help make this sustainable and more tolerable. So those are sort of some of the pearls. In terms of ILD, you know, the guidelines really do have pretty frequent imaging, high resolution CT to monitor the lungs. And, you know, if you look at the incidence curve of ILD, most will occur within that first year, but then it really does sort of plateau and there is still a risk of developing ILD beyond that year. So I do think we can't really be complacent and dismiss that potential risk because it does still exist. Oftentimes, you know, as folks are really having a complete response or excellent response and they're beyond a year, I may alternate my imaging for response assessment and stretch that out, but then sandwiched in between a high resolution CT chest just to keep an eye on things.
So let's talk about your cases a little bit. This is a 62-year-old lady who I guess presented in 2019. What happened then?
Happy to tell you. And I think what you'll see as a theme through these cases is the heterogeneity of triple negative breast cancer, right? So here, this woman presented several years back, you know, pre-Keynote, where she did receive neoadjuvant therapy, ER 30%, you know, sort of treated as a triple negative or an ER, you know, ER low with neoadjuvant weekly paclitaxel, changed to nab-paclitaxel because of allergy, had pretty quick progression and went on to dose-dense AC, went on to surgery and actually had a great chemo response with just a small amount of residual disease and had adjuvant capecitabine a la the CREATE-X trial. But then shortly thereafter, you know, about a year later, she had rising markers, was followed, you know, in the community. And we now know monitoring tumor markers is really not recommended by the Institute of Medicine. But in this case, it actually prompted imaging. And she was found to have mediastinal adenopathy, which on biopsy confirmed metastatic triple negative breast cancer that was PD-L1 positive. So I always think clinical trials are quite reasonable and necessary in our patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer. And in the context of screening for a trial, she had an MRI of the brain that found multiple CNS metastases. And she actually went to craniotomy because there was evidence of edema and she required a shunt and she had whole brain radiation. And on the heels of that was able to begin first line gemcitabine carbo-pembrolizumab a la Keynote 355. She had an outstanding response. So within 3 months, a complete response on scans and a quite durable benefit. So as you'll see over the many months thereafter, she was developing more difficulty with cumulative toxicity from drug than anything her breast cancer was doing. I ended up first dropping the gemcitabine because I really often will think it's the carbo that's giving the greatest benefit in combination with my pembro. So I stopped the gemcitabine due to thrombocytopenia, and she was able to then revert to an every 3 week schedule of carbo pembro. And then she had a completely unrelated trip and fall on the stairs and had a fracture in December of 2022, a C1 fracture and wrist fracture. So we held treatment for a while. She went through neurosurgery. She rehabbed for a bit. And I was able to resume her carbo-pembro in January. Again, through all of this, her scans are negative. She's maintained a durable, complete response. And finally, by June 2023, we had this shared decision-making to say, I think enough's enough, right? I think we might be causing more harm than good with chemotherapy here. And so we ended up stopping her chemo in June of 23, continued pembrolizumab as a maintenance. And here we are as of last month, still NED on imaging and tolerating single agent pembrolizumab beautifully. So really a narrative of, you know, a 4 year history with her metastatic triple negative breast cancer doing beautifully.
Wow. That can make a good movie, particularly that fracture. I can't even imagine at a human level how most of her family, you, after having gone, you know, gotten to this great level. Wow.
Right. It's a reminder that, you know, our patients are living their lives while they have breast cancer, right? That's our goal. We want to minimize the toxicity from treatment and enable them to do the things they love to do. But that also means they're at risk of all the other things that happen in life when you're in your 60s or your 50s or however old you are. And so we need to mitigate those and manage around those too.
She's got to be a pretty courageous lady. So curious, does she have any effects you can pick up in terms of the whole brain?
You know, she will intermittently have headaches. I always have a very low threshold to image her CNS again anytime that occurs. And fortunately, we haven't seen any occurrence of progression in the brain either. So aside from that upfront burden of disease and requiring the shunt and whole brain radiation, she's done quite well.
So what happened to the old short disease-free survival is not a good thing.
Right? Again, makes you wonder. I mean, this was over a year for her, right? And it does make you wonder if, in the absence of data saying there is no benefit with rechallenge, I have a low threshold to go ahead and rechallenge.
Yeah, I mean, I guess she could have got this benefit from the chemo alone, but I don't know. She'd had chemo before, too.
Correct.
Sounds a little immune. All right, 39-year-old.
Oh, so very different story here. A young woman who developed a quite locally advanced clinically T2N1 triple negative breast cancer, HER2-0. I think we always have to be precise about calling that out. At diagnosis, no evidence of distant disease. We did germline testing, which I do across the board in my patients with triple negative breast cancer, and this was wild type. She was married without children, underwent fertility preservation, and then jumped onto KEYNOTE-522. Unfortunately, within week 7 of 12 of the planned paclitaxel carboplatin combination, she had clinical progression. And so that was abandoned and she switched over to dose-dense AC with Pembro. And at the end of AC number 3, again, it looked quite concerning clinically and radiographically that she was progressing through AC Pembro. So she went right to the OR with bilateral mastectomies in May and had a large burden of residual disease, right? YPT2N1, good amount of cellularity there, really frustrating, not a great chemotherapy response. And so she was planning for post-mastectomy radiation. We actually were planning for one of the great adjuvant trials that are out there right now for women who have residual disease, where we're looking at moving up ADCs into the space with in combination with immunotherapy. And unfortunately, while planning for her post-mastectomy radiation, she ended up having headaches and visual change and was found to have CNS metastases as her first site of mets. And she was having not only quite a bit of symptoms, but shift. So she also required going to the OR for craniotomy. And the pathology was very much consistent with triple negative breast cancer. We routinely will check AR on all of our TNBC specimens, and her AR was positive. And here, HER2 came back low at one point, at 1+. So again, a reminder to always be testing and looking for these actionable biomarkers when our patients develop metastatic disease. So she finished her radiation therapy, and given this tempo, although this is first-line setting, I did challenge with sacituzumab in that first-line setting, really calling the paclitaxel, carbo, and AC as her prior therapy. I had no difficulty getting access to SASI. She was not a clinical trial candidate given the CNS metastases that had just been radiated. And so she is on first-line sacituzumab, tolerating it well, even despite I started rather quickly right on the heels of radiation because this tempo of disease had me quite concerned. And she's been doing well with this thus far. You know, I look at that AR 30% and I would love to be able to think about introducing an anti-androgen in study, but remember, she won't be eligible for the study because of that seizure threshold and past history of brain metastases. But I do think about with that HER2 1+ down the road, I would certainly think about T-DXd for her upon progression with sacituzumab.
And one of the things you brought up in your talk was the issue of T-DXd in the brain. It has more and more, it sounds like it's pretty active.
Absolutely. You know, the data I shared in the talk was from the HER2 positive population where we have much bigger numbers, but there clearly is signal of benefit and penetration there.
So I'm always curious about a case that begins 68-year-old practicing physician.
Right, right. So wonderful, wonderful, active, engaged physician who presented with a palpable mass back in 2019. She actually had a large burden of disease, and multiple biopsies performed in the left breast actually showed what looked like two different sort of subtypes of breast cancer coexisting. One that was a bit more hormonally driven at ER 50% and HER2 low. The other really ER low at 10%. So she had a scan at that time showing no evidence of distant disease and went on to neoadjuvant dose-dense ACT. And at the time of her mastectomy and axillary dissection, she had a large burden of residual disease. Again, of combined sort of histology, one that was more hormonally driven, ER about 20 to 30%, HER2 low, and another very ER low, I would venture to say triple negative, HER2 low. So covering all our bases here, she received post-mastectomy radiation. I placed her on anastrozole to cover the hormone receptor positive component, but I also gave her adjuvant capecitabine for 6 months to cover the triple negative component. Unfortunately, a bit on, by the summer of 2022, she started to develop some bone pain, and a scan showed suspicion for bone metastases. Upon bone biopsy, this tumor was ER zero and HER2 low. We were able to perform PD-L1 testing, and she was PD-L1. The tumor was PD-L1 negative. At this point, I also did sequencing. So I sequenced both the tumor from the biopsy as well as sent for circulating tumor DNA. Tumor sequencing was really unremarkable, but ctDNA picked up an ERBB2 mutation. At that point, I just filed away that information and proceeded with first-line chemotherapy. Thinking about quality of life impact, you know, she had had prior exposure to capecitabine more recently. Carboplatin dosing interval was feasible for her maintaining her practice and really well tolerated. So single agent carbo with denosumab, my hope was that she would have a long benefit, but she progressed at the first set of scans. Bone only, but really a large burden of disease and symptomatic there. And she did have some axillary nodes that had improved a bit. So with this data, you know, knowing she had strong HER2 low disease, she had had this mixed population of some being ER, more ER driven, as well as ER zero, I opted here to use T-DXd because of the heterogeneity of her disease. Also, for her, schedule was very important. So being able to dose once every 3 weeks was more favorable than doing weekly dosing. So she started T-DXd in October of 22 and did well for just over a year, but then had bone-only progression. And when we faced decisions, you know, last December about alternatives, we talked about sacituzumab, but I also looked at that sequencing, and on ctDNA, she still had that ERBB2 mutation present. And we had data from the SUMMIT trial, you know, a basket study looking at patients who had HER2 negative, so could have been HER2 low, but certainly not HER2 3 plus or amplified disease. And for those patients, even with triple negative breast cancer with ERBB2 mutations, there appeared to be benefit from neratinib and trastuzumab with nice responses, you know, over 30% response rate. And she loved the idea of a bit of a chemo holiday and taking oral therapy. And so we started neratinib and trastuzumab, careful about monitoring and managing diarrhea, but she tolerated that well. And she was able to get about 7 months on oral therapy as a bit of a chemo break before she had progression again in bone and a little bit of node. So this summer, she agreed to start sacituzumab. She's tolerating it beautifully. She's managing the 2 weeks on, 1 week off. After neratinib, the diarrhea with sacituzumab is like non-existent. She's managing that without difficulty. And her counts have been hanging in there well. She is having hair thinning, which is troublesome to her, but she's scalp cooling. And I'm hoping that she'll get long benefit here. Again, knowing we have benefit both in the hormone receptor positive space and the triple negative space for her.
It's interesting. I'm always curious when I see ERBB2 mutations in breast cancer. Of course, in lung cancer, first line therapy for HER2 mutant disease is T-DXd, and they see good responses. Yeah. And she was on T-DXd for, I guess, more than a year or two. But did she actually respond?
you know, she had stable disease, always a little tricky in the bone, but there was healing bone and reduced FDG avidity, but then ultimately progression. But yes, and I generally have very high expectation when I'm using T-DXd and even sacituzumab that I expect to see response.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Trena, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.